Welcome to the Show Me Institute podcast. I'm James Scholes, the director of research, and I'm super excited today to be joined by my friend, Ignacy Grau Callizo. You know, forgive my poor Spanish. My wife will make fun of me. You know, she is a Spanish teacher, so she'll probably make fun of my American pronunciation of your name. You know, Ignacy, we met a few years ago, and the first conversation I remember us having was bonding over a great new book by Roger Scruton at the time. And then I learned a little bit about what you do and your work at the United Nations, and I was just fascinated, partly because Americans, we really don't have a whole lot of idea and understanding of what goes on at the United Nations. Our experience mostly is tainted by what we see related to military conflicts and those sorts of things, but there's lots of other stuff goes on at the United Nations. And so I'm super excited to have you here to explain sort of to our audience, what does the United Nations have to do with education? And what is your role as General Director of OIDEL have to do with the United Nations? So thanks for joining us. Love if you could just tell us a little bit about your work.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Well, first of all, don't blame yourself about your Spanish because I have a Catalan name.
Ah.
So neither your wife will be able to pronounce it correctly. So, yeah, I'm the director of an NGO called OIDEL, which stands for International Organization for the Right to Education and Freedom to Education. Basically, what we do is we have a consultative status before the UN, which enables us to participate in international discussions that the states have among human rights issues, about human rights issues. There are many NGOs with this consultative status. Some of them are really influential, some of them don't. And basically what we do is we do research from a human rights perspective. And then we use this research to influence international discussions, especially in the field of education. I would say our main focus is freedom of education, so parental rights. We try to make sure that the voice of parents is heard and that parents and families are taken into account when the UN or other UN agencies or even some regional organizations decide to take decisions over the future of education.
So what sort of roles does the UN play in education? I mean, what are the types of things that they're making decisions on where you're trying to influence the policy?
This is a really important to understand. So the UN per se, this is really important to say because sometimes people tend to see the UN as the government of the world. And no, the United Nations is the administration that puts together the different states. The bosses of the UN would be the states. And when all the states agree, they can reach to agreements such as international treaties or declarations, which are bonding for those states who have accepted. For instance, the United States have ratified International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but has not ratified International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So covenants are binding, and the states have their methods to make sure, or at least to point the ones who are not doing so. But then in the meanwhile, now, especially now in a context of polarization like the one we are having now, countries can make political agreements. And basically they do resolutions, or they can appoint experts to make reports. They can make guidelines to guide the states. They can decide to, these are not binding documents, but they create a sort of soft law that in many countries, it can have a strong impact. And this is basically what the UN in the field of human rights, that's what we are seeing a lot today now. The UN is having discussions, which by that I mean like permanent missions. So states are having discussions on many human rights, amongst them education. And the outcome of these discussions usually are resolutions, which are political documents that it shapes language, it shapes conceptions, it shapes the way of understanding problems, and this later can have an important impact in national legislation. And you can say, how come? Well, either what happens many times is that at the national level, there is a discussion, and they are fighting over which category should we use. For instance, let's say we are talking about public or private, about parental rights. And they say, listen, should we use governmental schools versus non-governmental schools, public, private, for-profit, non-for-profit, which category? And many times these discussions end up by saying, why don't we use what the states had agreed? So as they agreed on public-private a long time ago, and it's really changed to change, it's really difficult to change UN language these days, and this has shaped the discussions on the right to do this. This sort of labeling of institutions has shaped the discussions on education around the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of my research has been historical in nature, looking at organizations that started in the 50s in the United States, Citizens for Educational Freedom, a person named Father Virgil Bloom, were very active in advocating for school choice in the United States. And they used to cite United Nations declarations of human rights as support for school choice. I don't see mm-hmm. that in the United States as much anymore. And I can't remember if the first time I heard about this was in reading some of their writings or if it was from you and pointing me towards Article 26 in the Declaration of Human Rights. And there's a point in there which I think that most Americans don't realize is there, but is incredibly important. And it says parents have a prior right to choose the kind of education that shall be given to their children. And it sounds like, you know, part of the work that you're doing is advocating that people recognize that human right that's right there in the Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations. Is that right?
Indeed, indeed. That's what we are doing in. So it's important also to put in context on that, if I may. After the Second World War, states realized that how did we get there, no? And they decide maybe, and they realize for once that there are natural rights. It's not just like there are rights that go beyond the positive rights. And they decide, why don't we make a document that say what human beings need in order they can make sure that their dignity is secure no matter where they are going. And that's the idea of human rights. Human rights, I think it's important that the idea of human rights is that it's linked intrinsically with the idea of dignity and the idea of the worth of the human being. It's important to say that because sometimes we tend to see human rights as a patrimonial right, you know, as something that we can dispose, but no, dignity is something that you cannot negotiate. Therefore, also human rights. So it's important because in the Article 26, there was not this wording. The prior right of parents to choose education, it was not in the first drafting, neither the purpose of education, which is the pre-development of personality, which means the free development of the human being.
Can I read that real quick? It says, education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Is that the point you're talking about?
Yeah. So in the first draft, this part and the part concerning parents was not in the first drafting. It was made by a French guy called René Cassin. And the Jewish recall that during the negotiations, the international, the OIC, well, the civil society organizations representing the Jewish people say, listen, in Germany, we had a system that was accessible for all, it worked well, and it ensured that everybody was able to read and learn mathematics. And yet, these people get to appoint one of the worst regimes in history. So they say, we need a soul. We need a soul for educational systems. So the purpose of education have to be the full development of personality, which is linked with the idea of person, not of personality. But yeah, the Dutch people, who were a big part of one of the victims of this regime, say, yeah, but if we include that and parents don't have the right to choose, easily the states will end up by doing the same thing. So they connect these two ideas, no? The full development of human personality and the right of parents to choose have been conceived together. Since then, this wording has appeared in many constitutions around the world. Like the constitution of my own country, Spain, is highly influenced by that. What has happened, though? The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a declaration, so it's a political document. Like, you can use it in political terms, and even we see courts using it, but it's not a legal document. What the international community agreed after 1946 is, well, they knew it from the beginning. We are going to do a declaration. That's how it works. So make sure we are all on the same page. And from there, we are going to do a treaty. But when they were negotiating the treaty, the Cold War had started, and it was way more complicated to do that. And they have created, at that point, they decide, okay, we're going to do two treaties, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. What is interesting, there are interesting, this is the, these are the binding treaties. These are the countries that have ratified these treaties. They are, in theory, they are obligated to fulfill that. And citizens, in theory, they should be able to go in court vindicating these rights. The right to education appears in both, but in different senses. In the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, there is freedom of education recognized. So the right of education is recognized under the formula of freedom of education as an essential part to fulfill freedom of religion and freedom of thought. While in the other one, there is more as the right to education is in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. The right to education is conceived as a social right. Yet also there is the right of parents to choose the right to choose the education they want for their children. And also there is the right of non-governmental actors to set up schools. Yet there is already a point which is really weird that says that parents can choose according to the minimum standards established by the state, which was one of the conditions that the USSR put there to make sure that they could accept this treaty. They could accept this article. And basically what has happened since that, after that moment, is that a big part of the fight at the UN is trying to define what are these minimum standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this seems like a tension in school choice policy everywhere, is that you have individuals who want pure choice, right? That parents mm-hmm. can choose with no regulations or rules at all. And then you have other individuals who say, will allow for choice as long as, you know, the state gets to determine the curriculum or the certain requirements. And so you have this debate all the time. And it sounds like you are seeing that on the national stage, whereas in the United States, I see it. You know, it's funny when I use the term state and you use the term state. We mean somewhat different things.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of our provinces that we call states. And you know, you're talking about countries. But mm-hmm. this is the same type of conversation that we have oftentimes. Is, to what extent do we allow individuals to make choices that other people might disagree with? You know, that they choose a religious type of education that they themselves wouldn't want to support, or a type of school that's focused on the arts rather than reading and writing or whatever it is. What level of freedom do we allow individuals? And it sounds like you're saying that is the same type of conversations that we're having here. What level of control should states be allowed to impose on individual choice? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's basically the tension we have had since then. And what we see even like with actors that are openly against, we see human rights activists that they say, I mean, as soon as you talk a little bit with them, you realize that they are openly against parents choosing the right. They are against parents choosing the education for their children. But then once you talk a little bit with them, once you talk with them, their language is more sophisticated. It's like, oh no, we want parents to choose. Like, parents are really important. They have to choose, but these are the minimum standards. Which at the end is like, what can they choose? What is left for them? Choosing the menu they are going to have for dinner?
They could choose anything off of our McDonald's menu or whatever.
Exactly.
You provide the menu for them.
And I think also here, there is an idea which is really important, because from a human rights perspective, the Covenant on the Rights of the Child says one thing, which is the right of education is the right of the child. And parents, what they have is responsibilities, obligations, and children. This is really important because sometimes people against parental rights, they mock parental rights like, oh, as if they have some sort of property rights. As I say, like, human rights are not patrimonial. They are linked with the idea of dignity. And they play a game here, which is like parents have this right because they are responsible. And they are responsible because the full development of human personality is not just making sure that we are preparing a good worker. We are preparing a person, not an individual. And a person means a culture, like being rooted in a concrete community, being rooted with some beliefs. And we talk a lot now about intercultural dialogue, but to have a decent intercultural dialogue, you have to know who you are. So the state cannot provide an answer to that, because a holistic education have to provide answers, have to provide some strong answers. So there is no consensus on, for instance, who was Jesus. We will never find a consensus, and this is not healthy. So from a human rights perspective, the language, what is behind the language is like parents are responsible because they cannot be responsible for that. Therefore, they have rights and also they have obligations. Mm-hmm. And here the role of the state is guarantor. And we see that in some of the binding documents. The state is guarantor to make sure that parents are acting as responsible. And by that, what they mean is like, we are not gonna follow parents by what sort of cosmovision they are transferring to their kids, but you know, they are not committing any violence, or they are not preventing their kids to learning something that eventually it could be necessary for them to develop as a person.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's really interesting. You talked about this Article 26 and these rights of the parents being inserted really as a check against the state and the state's power to control education, to enforce upon parents and children some sort of really negative ideology. I mean, it's really a control against the state. And yet it sounds like in the years since then, many states have continued to try to encroach upon this, to try to insert additional rules or regulations, to try to make it possible for the state to exert more control. And so I'm curious where you see the tides in the United Nations right now. Do you see strong support for parental and student rights to choose the type of education? Is there a movement away from that, movement towards it? You know, where do things stand?
I think the UN per se, it's hard to say, because the UN, I mean, the documents issued by the UN, we have two types. The ones issued by bureaucrats, which are not binding, and then the resolutions which are issued by the state. I see that the UN now, in one hand, from the UN system, we see documents that talk more about the right to public education. And they are start having this narrative about the right to public education. And they are talking about that within the minimum content, there are issues that go beyond mathematics, language, science, such as comprehensive sexual education. And then in the other hand, also one thing that I think is interesting is like, they realize that education has to go beyond, education has to go beyond preparing workers, and they are talking a lot about the importance of identity and culture, which is something they understand a lot when they are talking about indigenous people, minorities, and they realize that many times the best actor for fulfilling that is parents. These things can seem contradictory, but it makes sense because there is not there are different bureaucrats with different views on that, and these documents are not binding, and basically it's permanent missions, therefore states who are requesting, putting some budget for some reports, these people are making these documents, which are not binding, and we see this contradictory language. Then when we see the discussions of the states, we see a growing tension. If you go to any discussions on a state's discussion, discussing on education and resolution, the tensions today are on two issues. the role of family, and how important is comprehensive sexual education. And we're seeing a growing polarization across these two topics. The problem, of course, it's really anthropological. Also, there is many smaller states that are just following their allies on that. But we can see like African and Arabic countries really concerned about family not being part of educational discussions, and also really concerned about what the inclusion of comprehensive sexual education as something that it's not rooted in their culture and it's really imposed from a Western perspective. And on the other hand, we see Western states really that they are really, how could I say, like they have a lot of suspicion over the inclusion of families. And they are, some of them, like Canada, for instance, or like Scandinavian countries, who are really pushing for the inclusion of comprehensive sexual education in any document concerning education.
It kind of goes back to what you said at the beginning of you have to understand what the United Nations is, that it's not necessarily, one government, but it's many different nations that are, it's a forum where they're coming together and they're wrestling with these issues. And so there are lots of different points of view. You know, I've been writing about school choice in the United States context for many years, and I have grown accustomed to a certain line of arguments against school choice. You know, I'm used to most of the arguments that would come from, say, our teachers' unions or the people who are generally very pro-public education. Lately, though, there's been a new line of arguments that have been popping up, especially in Missouri, and I've talked to some of my colleagues around the country that this new line of argument is that school choice is actually some sort of United Nations plot, that it's, there's some sort of effort there to control education. And, you know, our audience can't see you shaking your head, but, you know, how do you respond to that sort of argument?
I wish. I mean, I'm fighting for that, and I can tell you this is not the case. I mean, if anything, I would say it's otherwise. There is an initiative, and again, this is really soft law, but probably one of the strongest initiatives that some of the actors of the UN have embraced, is the Abidjan Principles. And honestly, take a look at the Abidjan Principles, because the Abidjan Principles basically, it's an initiative from civil society, but they have been pushing for the adoption of these principles as part of the corpus on the right to education from a human rights perspective. And what this document is saying is that basically they are talking almost openly about the right to public education, which means the only obligation of the state is to make sure that all children have a place in a school run by the government. And if any government eventually funds non-governmental schools, it has to be as a time-bound measure, in the waiting of them making sure that they could bring these kids to public schools, and they have to justify it in a document. So I would say the main initiative, this is not an initiative of the UN. It's true though that some states and some bureaucrats of the UN are really trying to embrace that and really trying to include that in some documents. The USAID actually have taken this document as in some, we have seen some reference of this document in some USAID documents. But no, I mean, to be honest, I cannot think of any successful initiative at this point in favor of a school choice at the UN.
Just to be clear, when you said "I wish," you were saying "I wish there was a push for school choice," not "I wish that there was some sort of UN control."
indeed, exactly.
You know, I think part of what I take away from what you're saying, and this is my own experience as well, is that I believe school choice is good. Empowering parents with the right to direct the upbringing of their children is good. And yet it is something that we can't just, you know, pass and put in place and leave it be. It's a right that we have to continually advocate for and continually fight against encroachments by the state on that right. So it's not something that you are done with, but it's something you must, as you do with human rights, it's something you must continually fight for over and over again. And, you know, tell us a little bit more about your organization and where our listeners might be able to find out more about the work that you're doing.
Yeah. No, before that, like, I think there is one point here, like, that we are seeing is that people are afraid more than freedom. What people are really afraid is about trust. And I think, like, a democratic society and a society that try to build their policies around human rights is a society that trusts their citizens. And education cannot be an exception. Like, sometimes people try to portray a school choice like this is a market orientation. No, this is not about, this is about trust, trusting citizens. And here I am going to answer your second question. Like, one of the things we do, for instance, is the Freedom of Education Index. The Freedom of Education Index is an indicator that we publish every 5 years about the state of education, about the state of freedom of education in the world. And one interesting thing that we observe that is that there is a strong correlation between strong democracies and freedom of education. For instance, among the states that ban freedom of education, there is lovely democracies such as Cuba, North Korea, or Eritrea. So these are ironies apart, like, these are the countries in the bottom of freedom of education in the world. In the top, what we see is countries like Ireland, countries like Belgium, countries like Netherlands, countries like Slovenia, or the Netherlands having their own constitutions that not only that their constitution not only acknowledge freedom of education, but they say that the state have to fund the different options that parents want to choose for their children. So for me, it's quite ironically, when we see that some people try to oppose the idea of a school choice and the possibility of having a conversation.
Ignacy, thank you so much for your time today. It's wonderful hearing about the work you're doing. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. And if you want to know more, you could check our website, www.oidel.org. And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure seeing you again.